I was recently at a concert listening to a man called Stephen Wilson, who was described by the Telegraph newspaper a few years ago as the most successful musician in the UK you've never heard of, nominated 6 times for Grammy Awards. And after performing the first half of the set, which was 2 songs that lasted 45 minutes in total between them, he then asked the question to the audience, how many of you are here by mistake? I suspect that not many of you are here by a mistake for a talk on panpsychism this deep into the forum. Let me begin by telling you what I'm going to try and do this afternoon. I'm going to try and explain briefly panpsychism, both as a philosophical idea and as a cultural phenomenon, because I think we are seeing both come. So in other words, I'm going to try and describe briefly both the professional philosophical theory and the popular beliefs which adopt, adapt, or echo this philosophy. I've learned enough from the Germans to know that it's good to start with a series of definitions. Pantheism says everything is God. God is identical to the universe. Panentheism says everything is in God and God is in everything. Panpsychism says mind or consciousness is fundamental to reality. So panpsychism is the idea that mind or consciousness is fundamental to reality. It's in fact a philosophical position which seeks to offer an alternative to physicalism, the belief that everything just is matter, so that there is no difference between your brain and your mind, and substance dualism, which is the belief that mind and body are different substances. At this point, the clarity evaporates, because panpsychism is a family of theories within philosophy of mind, which seek to explain what's sometimes called the hard problem of consciousness. They seek to explain that the existence of consciousness in the human person by positing consciousness or mind or mentality or psyche as something which is fundamental throughout the natural world. So something that is present throughout is pan, something that is, if it's mind that's present throughout, mentality, psyche, hence you get panpsychism. So to claim that mentality is fundamental is to say that mind can neither be explained in terms of nor reduced to anything not non-mental. Now, precisely where and how mind and consciousness stop is something that panpsychists disagree about amongst themselves. We're all conscious, we're human beings. Panpsychists would say that my dog is conscious. They would say that insects are conscious. And some of them would say plants are conscious. There are books now on the wood wide web, how the mushrooms and fungus that are growing in the soil are passing information and communicating between trees. And then some of them would want to go on even further and say that the rocks are conscious, and maybe even electrons have some primitive form of mind or consciousness. But whether this is happening top down or bottom up, is something about which panpsychists disagree. Just to give you a quote from a declared panpsychist, panpsychism is the view that consciousness is a fundamental and ubiquitous feature of the physical universe. Doesn't necessarily mean that everything is conscious, but the basic commitment is that the fundamental building blocks of the physical universe, perhaps even fundamental particles like electrons and quarks, have incredibly simple forms of conscious experience. And then the very complex experience of the animal or human brain is somehow built up from these simpler forms of consciousness at the level of fundamental physics. Panpsychists need not think this table is conscious, but they may very well think the small particles making it up have some kind of very simple conscious experience. Now, I said that we'd got to a point in our definitions where clarity had begun to evaporate. One of the things which makes panpsychism tricky to pin down is like natural law, liberalism, or in the context of philosophy of science, terms like physicalism or naturalism. We're referring to a family of theories. And in the case of panpsychism, within that family, not all the members are talking to one another. Indeed, some of them are deeply opposed. So some panpsychists want to say, well, previously the choices when trying to work out the hard problem of consciousness are either materialism, physicalism on the one hand, there's only matter, there's no mind, and substance dualism, which says there's mind and matter, and we're a third way between the two. But panpsychism is also broad enough to capture the idea that there is mind everywhere instead of matter everywhere. Monism or idealism. Or it could be substance dualism everywhere. Dualism all the way down. There are more minds in the universe than we can conceive of. Some forms of panpsychism are non-reductive physicalists. Some panpsychists don't believe there's any transcendent reality. They just think we need a new paradigm for explaining our mundane experience and consciousness. Other panpsychists think that there's a whole wonderful world out there to which psychedelics would be a great way of obtaining some form of direct connection. So all sorts of different ideas coming and being packaged under this label. Where does the term come from? Well, the earliest form of this idea that we can find is Thales, the 6th century BC, Greek philosopher. We don't have his complete works, but we have one of his sayings, all things are full of gods, that they're permeated by the soul or movement or life principle, which because of its extent and power must be divine. And for Thales, even a magnet, apparently inanimate, causes motion and is therefore alive. And if you're tuned in to panpsychism, you might find panpsychist ideas in Heraclius and in Plato in the Timaeus. So there's some antecedents there. But the term is first used by the Italian philosopher Francesco Patrese in the 16th century. I've said a couple of times already, look at the lack of clarity we have when we're thinking about panpsychism. If you know anything about the history of philosophy, you will know that quoting Spinoza and Leibniz in the same breath is giving you an indication of the very different philosophies which can be given the label. For Spinoza, God is just another name for nature. His God is just the complete set of physical laws conceived or thought considered under a different aspect, just another way of looking at physics. For Leibniz, by contrast, God is the eternal and infinite being encompassing all perfections, and all beings, both actual and possible, exist as ideas in the mind of God. And two really very different philosophies, but both of them perhaps being capable of being labeled as Leibniz. And Leibniz is interesting because he's affirming that God is both all-powerful and all-good, that this must be the best of all possible worlds. That's the view for which he's lampooned by Voltaire in his book Candide. But for Leibniz, his significant qualification was that although we must believe that God is all-powerful and all-good, we do not have the necessary data to be able to confirm whether or not this is the case. In the 19th century, Schopenhauer revealed his views by entitling his masterwork The World as Will and as Representation, also translated into English, is as The World as Will and Idea. And that book does what it says on the tin. It sets out his view of the world as a consequence of a blind, striving will without reason or purpose. But the big figure who is strongly influencing modern panpsychists is Alfred North Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead is notoriously difficult to pin down or to understand, not least because, to quote, his work is many-sided and has the faults as well as the virtues of a vast attempt to construct a comprehensive system which will get everything in. Whitehead also comes from that characteristic vice of certain philosophers of using his own unusual terminology, and also because he's trying to provide a theory of everything, combining ideas from a wide range of disciplines which belong to different levels of abstraction and explanation, or even to different logical types. But what Whitehead wants to do is offer us a process philosophy, a dynamic model of reality. Summarizing Whitehead's thought, Peter Hicks says, "Nor should we divide mind as something active and matter as something passive. Reality is one. Mind is the product of nature, not something standing over against it. We should view everything as an organically interrelated, interdependent system in which events and processes are primary. The basic units of the universe are events, not things. These units combine together to form processes which are part of one great cosmic process." And just in case you're wondering where that leaves God, Whitehead does not see God as transcendent in the traditional sense. His naturalism requires that God, though eternal, should be inside the overall process and so share in it. God is in the process of becoming. He is the cosmic process. So who are the people promoting panpsychism? Within the English-speaking world, two figures are especially important. And those two figures are Ian McGilchrist, who wrote a really easy, accessible 1,600-page book called The Matter with Things. If you want to follow what he's doing in that book, I've got a nice, neat article on him in Science and Christian Belief, which identifies 11 key propositions in his view, the second of which is these. Matter is an aspect of consciousness, not consciousness being an emanation from matter. So there he is, nailing his cross to the panpsychist mast. No surprise that when you go through and look at his work, you will find him talking very heavily about and appreciatively about the influence of Alfred North Whitehead on him. And he then reflects on a quite idiosyncratic account of the Christian mythos, as he calls it, where he says, "The extraordinary power of the Christian mythos lies in its central idea of incarnation, the intimate relationship between consciousness and matter, and the core idea of panentheism." So not only does he think that he is a panpsychist, he thinks that we ought to be as well. Philip Goff, who is constantly on Twitter and YouTube, debated William Lane Craig on this issue and has a really accessible book called Why, The Purpose of the Universe, which contains some typical British humor as well as some serious and semi-serious philosophical arguments, wants panpsychism as an attractive middle way between traditional belief in God and secular atheism. The third person on the slide, Joanna Leddenhag, is a Christian theologian teaching theology and philosophy at the University of Leeds, and she thinks that panpsychism is a better philosophical alternative to materialism than substance dualism. We'll come back to that later. Why is panpsychism back as a philosophical theory? Well, you've got, as the alternatives, substance dualism, the idea that there's mind on the one hand and body on the other hand. And that is unfashionable for two reasons. The first reason, shown on the slide, is that many atheist and agnostic philosophers fear that once they have accepted substance dualism, then they are accepting the existence of God. Now, that is, of course, what we would call an a priori objection. You're not measuring it on its merits. You don't like the consequences of where accepting this idea will go. And of course, for Christians, by contrast, substance dualism may seem a good fit because, after all, the Bible calls us to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second reason that philosophers are rejecting substance dualism is because of what is perceived to be the reductive way in which Galileo and Descartes describe matter. So for Descartes and Galileo, matter becomes bland because it is reduced to the properties which can be described mathematically and tested by third-person experiments. So qualities such as color cease to be matter because they cannot be measured. The effect of what it is like to taste a really good glass of red wine ceases to be material on this approach because there's no way of doing a mathematical formula for what's called the qualia in technical terms, the qualities, to put it in ordinary English, the what is it like of conscious experience. That first person experience of what it is like to be you. So the criticism is what's happening here is that we've been operating in physics and chemistry and biology, have been operating with a method which is very good at describing those aspects of reality that can be described mathematically, those aspects of reality where we can do repeat experiments, but is terrible at describing even those aspects of the world around us that can only be experienced firsthand. Yeah, we have an awful example near here the death camp at Auschwitz. I can tell you what I like about the death camp at Auschwitz. You have to go in order to know. And even then, you would have had to be there back in the 1940s to really sense the full horror. And that falls outside of this kind of reductive approach to matter. So people want to get away from that. They're also worried that reductive materialism is forced to explain away consciousness and free will. It leaves us in a world without purpose and without love. The physicalists say everything is matter, there is no mind. So the solution to that seeks to avoid substance dualism is emergentism. So emergentism is the idea you have some simple stuff, and once you combine it together in a particular way, you get something new that appears, that has new properties that emerge out of the combination. So emergentism says once upon a time there was just blind, non-sentient matter. And then there came a point when the biochemistry was right, the amino acids were right, and life starts. And then it goes on, and then when life gets to a particular stage, then we go again and we get consciousness. As C.S. Lewis put it in Miracles, the great interlocking event called nature might be such as to produce at some stage a great cosmic consciousness, an indwelling God arising from the whole process as human mind arises, according to the naturalists, from human organisms. One of the problems with emergentism as an idea is once you've got it started as a process, where does it stop? It seems to have this runaway train-like element to it, which if you don't stop it, ends up with this kind of imminent God that you've ended up with. But as Simon Conway Morris says, it's a nice story, it's a nice narrative, but it's not an explanation. Yeah, the whole point about emergentism is it's not able to give you an account of the point at which these new developments and new properties emerge. Well, that means what you've got is a story. You haven't got any sort of testable hypothesis. Now, I've mentioned C.S. Lewis could see the runaway train of emergentism leading to this kind of imminent God. It's worth noting that as a matter of genealogy, Samuel Alexander, C. Lloyd Morgan, and C.D. Broad, a trio of British emergentists in the 1920s, all employed emergence theory to remove the need to invoke any mystical or supernatural agencies. If you take this idea that C.S. Lewis has of God emerging, Leidenhag says, well, emergence theism can posit a Christ who is a new emergent, a superman that has appeared out of humanity, but can't imagine a God who's descended to become incarnate. Just an aside on classical theism, panentheism, and the gospel. So we've been talking about panpsychism now. It fits, or can be seen to fit quite nicely with panentheism, at least in some of its forms. Classical theism affirms that God is reliable in control of events and in control of himself. What panentheism wants is a God who is involved in and invested in what happens to creation. So the risk that classical theism has is if classical theism is articulated in abstraction from a robust understanding of the incarnation, you can kind of end up with a God who seems to be emotionless or disinterested and potentially unloving and cold, contrary to the biblical picture. The problem with panentheism is that basically God and the world are in a codependent relationship. That God's very existence and future is vulnerable to and dependent on what happens in the world. Classical theism, if you line that up with substance dualism and you say that only human beings have mind as well as matter, can kind of reduce down the purpose of the universe and the incarnation to just God simply rescuing human beings. So the rest of the creation is just background scenery for that that is happening. Panentheism, as we've seen already, has difficulty accounting for the incarnation as a unique event. A little bit of a handle so far on what it is as a popular philosophical theory. Let me talk to you now about it at the popular level. What cultural vacuum is panpsychism filling? Well, I mentioned Philip Goff, his Oxford University Press book, Why the Purpose of the Universe, gives you a clue as to how he thinks his ideas are cashing out. New atheism has failed to provide satisfying answers to our human needs for comfort, meaning, and purpose. Individualism has left us feeling isolated, alone, with crises of loneliness and belonging. And rationalism doesn't feel reasonable because it cannot satisfactorily account for our experiences, feelings, and intuitions about what is out there. We want to feel loved. We want to feel like we belong. We want to feel that we have significance and purpose. And at a popular level, panpsychism promises that. And my children's generation will say things like, "The universe told me." And that's the affirmation that I'm on the right track, that I was born this way, that I should be expressing myself in the way, all the sort of comfort of being part of something bigger, but without the personal God who is saying, this is good and this is evil, this is the way, walk in it. That's where I see we are. Now, how do we respond discerningly to both the philosophy and to the popular version? I think so far as the popular version is concerned, if we're at all involved in apologetics or evangelism, we need to realize that this is increasingly where people we are talking to may be coming from. You know, it fits nicely with that kind of vogue for being spiritual but not religious. So the Advanced Apologetics Network tomorrow are doing a sort of three-way discussion where the Christian has to respond on the one hand to the traditional atheist who thinks he's a rationalist, but on the other hand to the new person who thinks they're spiritual. And those are people who are in very different places when we want to talk to them about the claims of Christ. What about us? Did you spot that we sang a song on the first night of the forum about all creation crying out to God. Psalm 98, let the sea resound and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Let the rivers clap their hands. Let the mountains sing together for joy. Let them sing before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. Isaiah 55:12, you will go out with joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst into song before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Habakkuk 2:10-12, in a warning against those who have acquired wealth unjustly. You've plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the walls will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by injustice. And in Luke 19:40, where the Pharisees asked Jesus to shut his disciples up, he replies, I tell you the truth, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. So Joanna Leadenhall, who's written a book called Minding Creation, says, ooh, hello. Panpsychism might be able to take these ideas and treat them as more than metaphors. Now, there are other things that are going on as well. Yeah. Lynn White wrote in The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, in antiquity, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own genius loci, its own guardian spirit. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation and keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. So that's been a kind of standard critique of eco-paganism against Christianity. And we might respond, or be tempted to respond, well, actually, do you know what? Panpsychism begins to enable us to rethink what the biblical command to subdue and rule the earth, the command to steward the world in Genesis 1:28, that we have in Genesis 1:28. She wants to go on and say that it provides powerful resources for seeing creation as a cathedral of praise for the glory of the Creator. She wants to say that we can affirm panpsychism, but do so in ways that do not commit us to process atheism or to panentheism. She looks at it and thinks, well, panpsychism gives us the ability to ground values objectively, to say that things have worth as a fundamental feature of the universe, a way of opposing the mechanistic utilitarianism of a materialistic culture. We can think of panpsychism as a way of describing how the Holy Spirit is at work in the world beyond human subjects. So it's really interesting book that she has written, but a few things to be aware of. Austin Farrer said we must maintain a proper distinction of saving faith from pious philosophy, so that the theologian's vitals are not torn away when their philosophy is jettisoned. Philosophy comes with its trends and fads. And if you say, look, this philosophy proves Christianity today, you may find that when that philosophy has been overturned, if you are too heavily dependent on it, then the credibility of your theological claims go away. Mindful of Farrer's warning, Leadenhag is careful to insist that panpsychism alone does not generate theological insights. Instead, what she wants to do is to use panpsychism as an ontological framework and to see whether it allows theologians to speak more clearly of the presence of God and the value of creation on the one hand, but of the distinction between God and creation. So this is where she's decisively different from McGilchrist or Gough or Alfred North Whitehead. She says, you know, absolutely fundamental to Christian theology from the time of Nicaea onwards that we were hearing about last night is the creator-creation distinction. With God is always on one side of the equation and everything in creation is on the other side of the equation. What Nicaea was working out decisively was that Jesus was on the God side of the ledger and not just the greatest thing in creation on the other side of the ledger. Also, what she wants to say is that we must not allow panpsychism to affect the central Christian doctrines relating to the incarnation and the crucifixion and the resurrection. All of those are to be determined solely on a biblical basis. Now, we're going to be under pressure here because Philip Gough was raised Catholic. He then became a value nihilist, a complete skeptic, thought there were no moral values in the world. And then he's been on this kind of journey back towards panpsychism. And in a recent debate with William Lee Craig, described himself as being a slightly heretical Christian, by which he means he accepts that God is all good, but says that that means that God cannot be all powerful. He accepts that Jesus was incarnate, but denies that he needed to die for our sins. He wants a much more kind of Eastern Orthodox picture of us being healed and returning to oneness with God, much more kind of mystical approach. And indeed, consistent with that mysticism, he doesn't think that the resurrection was anything other than a mystical experience. But yeah, this is a sort of, you know, Christianity light that he wants, because he wants to get back actually to many of the things in terms of religious practices, meditation, involvement in churches, community, and so on, but without the dogmas that he found unpalatable, without the God of classical theism, without the scandal of the cross. So, we need to maintain the creator-creation distinction. We need to make sure that we're getting our fundamental theological insights from the Bible. We need to affirm that the incarnation, the crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ were unique events. They're not the result of some other process. They're entirely sui generis. That is what Nicaea was pointing us towards. The question is, and I hold this with an open hand at the moment, the question is whether doing all of that, we can go as far as Leadenhag does, where she says, in the Christian Bible, we get lots of passages, particularly in the prophetic texts, where nature, trees, mountains, rivers, and things are depicted as praising God or lamenting evil. Although it's clearly poetic and metaphorical, I think it has a realistic aspect too. There's a sense in which creation could praise its creator and respond to God, and that God could be present in the consciousness of the world whilst not being identical to it, that should be inviting and compelling from a Judeo-Christian perspective. So what challenges does panpsychism pose to the gospel? Well, slightly it depends which version of panpsychism we're talking about. You know, bottom-up panpsychism is repackaged animism. We're back to a world of competing spirits, full of gods with a small g. Remember St. Boniface, what he did when he was told that there were all these trees in the forest that were sacred? He just took an axe to one of them, chopped them down, and said, well, let's see what happens. Is the genius loci of this particular tree going to come after me? And that was a compelling indication that that wasn't the case. Second thing to be aware of, fighting against naturalism and physicalism and materialism, there's been a popular apologetic strategy that says, look at the hard problem of consciousness. The hard problem of consciousness demonstrates that naturalism, materialism, physicalism is not tenable. We all know this because we all have first-person conscious experience. And it is not only that there is no scientific answer to this, there's not even a model of what a credible project for exploring consciousness would look like. It's just the kind of problem that the scientific method cannot deal with, that reductive naturalism cannot explain. And the argument runs, well, now I've told you that because you're all conscious, and I've told you that the only alternative is off the table, well, theism is the answer. And what panpsychism does is it comes into that apologetic argument and says, actually, you don't head straight to theism at this point. Here's a side route. Here's another option that you can go down. So I think panpsychism potentially is an inoculator against the gospel, something which offers the attractions of a world in which there is magic and comfort and purpose, but without the moral demands made by the God of classical theism. Now, how might we tackle those two issues? Well, in relation to the question about consciousness, you're still left with the question, why is consciousness a fundamental feature of the universe? Although panpsychism doesn't require God to inject minds into the universe at successive intervals, so it's different from intelligent design in that way, it does stand firmly within the logic of the cosmological argument. Panpsychism still needs a cause or a reason, a creator, to bring about and sustain the fundamental level of reality on which panpsychism's account of consciousness is built. As to the last point, panpsychism offering this kind of comfort of living in an apparently meaningful universe. Well, you've still got the question, why does something exist rather than nothing? And you have the problem of working out what is the end goal. Yeah, what is this evolving process moving towards? Are we the last stage of that? If you were at Andrew Fellow's workshop on transhumanism, you'll know there are a whole bunch of people out there who think we're just on the next stage towards something else. And certainly at the time he was writing his book, Why, Philip Goff is arguing that, you know, evolution, we have no reason to think evolution has stopped with us and that the evolution of the world towards something is going somewhere else. All very presumptive. What opportunities does panpsychism create for the gospel? This, by the way, is from the latest Bridget Jones films. For those of you who may be wondering what the shot is, it's a fireside chat on a school camping trip. The scientific naturalist claims that any talk of the world being enchanted or of God is nonsense. But for panpsychists and panentheists, talk about spirits and God is on the table. And because mind is fundamental to the universe, you're left with either as a brute fact, or as a mystery, or as evidence that the universe is the product of a divine mind. Panpsychism implies that the universe has meaning and purpose, but can give us no certainty as to what that is. Christianity shows us what the meaning and purpose of the universe is. The fact that we have a personal God is the best explanation for our personal consciousness. The fact that we have a God of love and justice is the best explanation that our destiny is a world full of love and justice. It's just that when you take 2 Peter chapter 3 and you look at how that works, it passes through the final judgment, and then we are promised as Peter said, we have this hope, this promise of a world where justice will rule or where righteousness will dwell. Much more clarity that is given through divine revelation than there is through philosophical speculation. There's a risk indeed that panpsychist eco-philosophy presents a maximally selfish universe in which each subjectivity in the universe structures the world in a fundamentally egotistical way. What are those conscious electrons all up to? And are they up to good or are they up to no good? All of these kinds of questions get created and thrown up by panpsychism. Panpsychism, in internal terms, is stuck with what's sometimes described as the combination problem. So you have all these little proto-consciousnesses, and they combine, and at some point they combine to produce the unified consciousness that I am having whilst talking to you, or that you're having whilst talking to me. Well, how does that work? And for a panpsychist like Goff, he wants to have his cake and eat it, because he wants to say, not only have you got these little proto-consciousnesses that have somehow combined to make us conscious, we all, by the way, are part of one universal consciousness. And how can that be working at two different levels? There are all sorts of issues, and the panpsychists admit that they don't have the answer to that question or any way of seeing it through at that point.